Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots and partially solar-powered community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of the show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. Please get some notebook, paper, and pen so you can take notes during the show. First, we always start with some debt-related news and facts for the week. An article from the Huffington Post. Disappearing middle class. Bilingual PhD accepts rent money from church. Until 18 months ago, Maria Ortiz says she never had to search for a job in her life. As a highly skilled bilingual PhD and the first ever Mexican-American woman to be admitted into Brigham Young University's Graduate School of Management, Ortiz was always the kind of woman universities would beg to come work for them. After working and teaching in California for 20 years, Ortiz was recruited in 2007 for a highly specialized job at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. She left her stable situation to take a chance on a new program she believed in, but the program folded due to budget cuts less than 2 years later, in January 2009, right in the middle of the recession. Ortiz frantically applied for jobs for the next 18 months, running through all $15,000 of her savings, exhausting all 99 weeks of unemployment benefits, and eventually having to draw from Social Security and accept financial aid from her local church congregation to help pay the rent. Monday morning, on her 63rd birthday, Ortiz says she received yet another job rejection phone call, and she felt like she could no longer hold it together. "I cried the whole day on Monday," she told HuffPost. "It's painful. It's embarrassing. I worked so hard. I have all this experience in education. I was careful and prepared. I kept savings. I did everything right. Why am I living on handouts? I always felt like there were needy people out there that needed the help more than I did. But now I am turning into one of those people. Look at this. This is how the middle class is evaporating." Ortiz lives in Las Vegas, Nevada, where the unemployment rate is currently the highest in the country. She says that while people often think of higher education jobs as being in a different category than most others, like construction or healthcare, she has experienced the same frustrations applying in her field as anyone else. "You go through the trouble of applying. People know you. People recommended you. You're looking forward to the interview. Then a few days later, they send you an email saying, 'I'm sorry, but because of budget cuts, we're suspending the search.' It's no longer frustrating, it's enraging. Why do they advertise these positions in the first place if they don't really exist?" she said. Ortiz said when she does actually get an interview, she almost always receives a rejection phone call or email with no satisfying explanation. They'll say, "Don't take it personally. We really liked you, but there were 45 applicants, and the board decided they liked another candidate better," she said. "Well, that's pretty discouraging to hear. I have a PhD, 18 years of experience, impeccable recommendations, and I'm applying for a job that pays a third of what I used to be making. What do I need to do to be liked?" Ortiz received her last unemployment check on June 28th, and she only has $300 left to her name. although the Senate finally passed a bill to extend unemployment benefits for those whose checks prematurely expired, Ortiz falls into the category of the 99ers who have already used up their full amount. Without any extra help on the way, she says she's now looking into some minimum wage online translating jobs to help her keep up with her car note. "I have a degree hanging up in front of me," said Ortiz, in tears on the phone. "I was such a proud, successful student. I used to tell my own students, work hard, make grades, finish your degree, and then you will see a change in your earnings. Well, it would be very hard to make the same speech to them now if I ever make it back to teaching. I mean, look at me." So that was from the Huffington Post by L. Bassett. And from Max Gardner, "GM used our money to buy subprime lender and is exempt from the new Consumer Protection Agency. Last year, the U.S. government bailed out auto giant GM at a cost of around $50 billion, gaining 61% of the company in the process and expecting around $20 billion in eventual losses. The government also bailed out its lending arm, GMAC, at an upfront cost of $17.2 billion and an expected eventual cost of $6 billion. Last week, backed by that taxpayer largesse, GM paid $3.5 billion to purchase a subprime lender, meaning GM will pay taxpayers back in part by selling them more cars at less advantageous interest rates. Plus, Felix Salmon notes GM did not even get a good deal on the company. The government is now using taxpayer money to buy out AmeriCredit shareholders at a 24% premium to Wednesday's closing price last week. The incident underscores how pointless the auto dealer carve-out in the financial regulatory reform bill is as well. As a standalone company, in a matter of months, AmeriCredit would have come under the regulatory oversight of the new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. CFPB regulators would have prevented it from using the industry's worst practices, bait-and-switch scams, hiding fees and interest rates in the small print, selling unnecessary insurance products, or offering subprime loans to prime qualified customers. But since GM bought AmeriCredit and will roll its services into the company's auto dealership, the CFPB will not be able to do so. So that's an analysis from Max Gardner. And from a related article in the Washington Independent, "Auto Dealer Exemption, a Lock for Financial Regulation," by Annie Laurie. Let's say you are in the market for a new car and you head down to view the stock at your local auto dealer. You pick out your car and decide to go ahead with the purchase. You make a decent salary, but do not have the funds to pay in full, in cash. In all likelihood, rather than heading to your bank or local credit union, you will sit down and hear an offer from a lender right in the dealership. The dealer will finish the loan paperwork that afternoon, and you can drive off that evening. There are 18,000 auto dealerships that make loans, and according to the studies of consumer advocates, they often do so using deceptive and predatory practices. Most dealerships do not directly provide the credit for borrowers. They grant a loan and then resell it to another financial company. Often, the dealership charges the borrower a higher rate than the creditor requires, keeping the difference between what the car buyer pays in and the financial company takes back as a kickback. According to the Center for Responsible Lending, those kickbacks make auto dealerships $20 billion a year. Many dealers offer subprime car loans for borrowers with tarnished or no credit, meaning sometimes that borrowers pay more than twice the value of their car. They use bait-and-switch scams, changing financing terms after the deal is made. One in four borrowers who made less than $25,000 was scammed last year, and one in eight making less than $40,000 a year. People of color are more likely to get bad loan terms. The CRL found that more than half of black borrowers were charged kickbacks compared with 31% of white borrowers. The bottom line, car dealerships sell financial products, not just cars. It makes sense that they would come under the purview of the new Consumer Financial Protection Agency, a rulemaking body created by the Financial Regulatory Reform Bill. But they won't. President Obama has walked back his promise to veto the bill if auto dealers are exempted. And last week, the House and Senate negotiators agreed to exempt them. The political reality is that those of us who have fought against an auto dealer carve-out can't prevail, said Representative Luis Gutierrez, Democrat from Illinois. Instead, Senate Democrats have proposed holding auto dealers to CFPA regulations through a Federal Reserve-enforced Truth in Lending rule. The Federal Trade Commission would have authority over auto dealers. The CFPA would have no direct oversight except over a few big companies that provide their own financing. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now we'll continue with the second part of the show. We have, over some period of time now, been learning from the book, The Two Income Trap, Why Middle Class Parents Are Going Broke by Professor Elizabeth Warren and Amelia Warren Tyagi. And recently have been looking at how the bankruptcy bill was formulated and staved off at the turn of the century, particularly by the women's groups and their strength in dealing with some political issues. But before I get started, I'd like to give some credit because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of Professor Elizabeth Warren from Harvard and her daughter Amelia Warren Tyagi, and I highly recommend their books, All Your Worth and The Two Income Trap. You can also visit the archives at www.kruufm.com under Life and Debt, and you can get an opportunity to listen to all of the prior shows which have been produced regarding debt and its influence on your life. One of the points that Professor Warren made when she was talking about the analysis of the evolution of the bankruptcy bill, and at that point when she wrote her book, how it was stopped, she really, as in many of the situations regarding her theories, focuses on families. She basically rips through these dichotomies and battles and polarization between liberal, conservative, faith-based, or secular, and all these polar battles that go on among the middle and lower class people in particular, and focuses on the issue of family. She says that the mission of all of these groups is really family when you look through it, as a principle underlying all of the other more superficial kinds of battles going on. So all these groups see that because families are highly impacted by interest rates, interest rate regulation and bankruptcy protection should be at the very top of the agenda for all of these groups. Predatory lending is a family issue. Usury is a family issue. Bankruptcy is a family issue. These laws affect families, people with children, more than anything else. She says that there is likely no other issue, divorce, welfare reform, child custody, that will directly touch more middle-class families than the mortgage and credit card interest rates that drain away their economic viability and sap the intimacy and joy from family life. When the book was published, that's where it all stopped. Since then, when we look at the continued evolution of the bill after 2002 and 2003, there was an increase in Republican majorities in the Senate and the House, particularly after 2004 elections, and that breathed new life into the bill, which was reintroduced in its current form by the chairman of the Finance Committee, Republican Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa. The bill was supported by President Bush back then, and Tom DeLay also championed the controversial legislation. The bill was passed by large margins, 302 to 126 in the House and 74 to 25 in the Senate, and was signed into law by President Bush to become effective in 2005. There were some initial criticisms of the 2005 Act, also known as BAP CPA. It was opposed by a wide variety of groups: consumer advocates, legal scholars, retired bankruptcy judges, and the editorial pages of many national and regional newspapers. Criticisms of the bill were wide-ranging, but the central objections of its opponents focused on the bill's sponsors' contention that bankruptcy fraud was widespread, and the strict means test that would force more debtors to file under Chapter 13, which is a type of bankruptcy where a percentage of debts must be paid over a period of 3 to 5 years, as opposed to the Chapter 7, under which debts are paid out only from any non-exempt existing assets. There were additional penalties and responsibilities that the bill placed on debtors, and the bill's many provisions were favorable to credit card companies, at least so it seemed at the beginning. Opponents of the bill regularly pointed out that the credit card industry spent more than $100 million lobbying for the bill over the course of 8 years. One of the primary stated purposes of that bankruptcy bill was to cut down on abusive or fraudulent uses of the bankruptcy system. As Congressman F. James Sensenbrenner, Jr., Republican from Wisconsin, and one of the bill's key supporters in the House, argued, quote, "This bill will help restore responsibility and integrity to the bankruptcy system by cracking down on fraudulent, abusive, and opportunistic bankruptcy claims." On the other side, opponents of the bill argued that claims of bankruptcy abuse and fraud were widely overblown, and that the vast majority of bankruptcies were related to medical expenses and job losses. And their arguments were bolstered by an in-depth study by Harvard University medical and legal scholars, and one of those scholars happens to be Professor Elizabeth Warren, and also, I believe, Professor Katie Porter from the University of Iowa's legal department, who worked for Professor Warren at that time. And that study found that more than half of bankruptcies cited medical issues as a contributor to the bankruptcy. So what we're hearing is that the reasons behind promoting the bill and the reality of why people file bankruptcies were very different. At that time, the most controversial provisions of the bill were the strict means test provisions, which establishes whether a debtor's filing under Chapter 7 of the Code would be considered as an abuse and therefore subject to dismissal. This kind of decision was always there in the bankruptcy law abuse, but the decision was made by the bankruptcy court judge, who would evaluate the particular circumstances that led to the bankruptcy. That seemed reasonable and honorable, particularly with respect to honoring the judges. But this law was going to reverse that, that is, take it out of the hands of the judges. The critics of the means test, which is triggered if a debtor makes more than the state's median income, argued that it ignored the many causes of individual bankruptcies, job loss, family illness, predatory lending, and would force debtors seeking to challenge the test into costly litigation, driving them even further into debt. So a curious thing occurred. People without money were being forced to spend more money or risk more money to prove that they don't have money and have not only debt, but legitimate debt that in most cases came from circumstances beyond their control. So let's take a short break If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So I've just been discussing the current bankruptcy bill, which became law in 2005, and some of the initial criticisms about the law. And one was the means test and what it caused in terms of costs to the debtors. Other criticisms of the law, besides the stricter means test, centered around the many other obstacles the bill created for individuals seeking bankruptcy protection. These included more detailed reporting requirements. So that means a lot more paperwork, which again resulted in higher cost for the debtors because of the fact that lawyers had to do a lot more paperwork and a lot more corroboration of what the client was providing and stating. There were higher fees. It cost now 50% more to file the bankruptcy to the court alone from before the 2005 law. There's also mandated credit counseling before you file your bankruptcy, and then mandated debtor education. These are classes, contact classes. They're not for testing, but it's time and it's expense, both before you file your bankruptcy and after you file the bankruptcy. Plus, there was a lot more liability placed on bankruptcy attorneys, at least theoretically, in what is called due diligence. Critics argued that this would drive up attorneys' fees and decrease the number of lawyers willing to help consumers file. And this actually did happen for quite a while. I think it's only been recently, in the last maybe 18 months, where general practitioners were getting back into filing bankruptcies, which they did before the law, but then backed out when all of these new uncharted provisions became the challenges in the bankruptcy law. Much of the criticisms were borne out. The bankruptcy process is significantly more arduous, and there are higher fees and many more issues that can come up in a bankruptcy case, even though the result is usually the same, in fact, dramatically the same as it was prior to the law. It's just more hoops to jump through with, of course, related costs pushed on the debtor. There were some provisions beneficial to credit card companies, and these were a major target of the bill's opponents. In particular, critics objected to the extension to 8 years rather than 7 between filings of bankruptcies, so the debtor could liquidate their debt through bankruptcy, but would have to wait more time if they had ever done it before. The most critical of all of the issues, however, regarding the credit card companies was that the predatory practices of these companies, such as exorbitant interest rates, rising and often hidden fees, and targeting minors in the recently bankrupt for new cards, were not addressed issues in the law. And as we've discussed in the past, these issues themselves, these practices themselves, significantly contribute to the growth of consumer bankruptcies. But with all of this as criticism, the bill did become law in 2005, and over the last 5 years, thanks to the various consumer advocates, including the National Association of Consumer Bankruptcy Attorneys, which has over 4,000 members, many of the law's unclear and even conflicting provisions, which were in too many cases poorly worded, mostly being written by the credit card industry itself, have been challenged and clarified and understood in a much better context, even though it's not ideal, for the reality of what consumers are facing, and also providing ways to deal with the challenges of debt in a much more realistic and grounded way. But the bankruptcy law, like all things negative that are attached to it, becomes the focus of genuinely good and highly intelligent human beings, and over time regains some balance and opportunity. It takes people like Professor Elizabeth Warren, her daughter Amelia Warren Tyagi, and some of the leaders in organizations like the National Association for Consumer Bankruptcy Attorneys to act like surgeons and restore health, which has happened quite a lot in the last 5 years since the bankruptcy law has passed. It's an ongoing process and a never-ending process in a field of change, but if we can be on a stable and balanced raft rather than a concrete boat, we can find our way through all of the challenges with the help of navigators who assist during the storm. So there are a lot of really good people out there who are helping to restore economic viability and the intimacy and joy of family life, and they should be highly congratulated. Right now, Professor Warren is going through some really interesting challenges in terms of the Consumer Financial Protection Agency, but it's our sincere hope that personalities and intellect and hearts like Professor Warren possesses get these kinds of roles in our society to help middle-class families, to help lower-class families, to help people without all of the money and power that seem to be running not only the economy, but the government and the media, which supposedly informs us about what is happening. So let's get back to a discussion on the family and specifically the two-income trap. How should a family protect itself from the two-income trap? Professor Warren holds that the deck is stacked against today's parents who struggle to solve financial problems on their own. We talked about the bidding wars for houses in good school neighborhoods, and a generation of those bidding wars launched an army of competing buyers against any family that tried to cut back on its spending. There were a generation of layoffs, which are continuing, divorces, which are continuing, spiraling medical costs, which have hit pretty much everyone. Professor Warren is definitely a grassroots proponent. She believes in collective action, recommendations for Congress and state legislatures, political action groups, faith-based organizations, school districts, and community institutions. All of these have a part and can be mobilized in the direction that the masses want. She firmly believes that collective action is the most effective remedy and that it is essential for reestablishing the economic security middle-class parents so badly need. However, she admits, big changes take time, but families need to safeguard themselves immediately, right here, right now. So what should families do? There are a lot of very good practical suggestions. One thing that everyone should do is, if you are raising a family, read a good book on financial planning. And I highly recommend, having read it many times myself and living by the principles brought out in the work, the book All You're Worth by Professor Elizabeth Warren and, again, her daughter Amelia Warren Tyagi. This is not a book you need warning about. This is a fantastic, simple, cut to the chase, down to earth approach to dealing with budgets and one's personal and family economy. And we will continue to discuss this next week. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me directly at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous, yet manageable life.